So, hello everybody. Our next talk is coming. So it is Sarah Schulist who will ask what is it that we are revitalizing and will take us towards a holistic model of language revitalization in an urban context.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming this morning. I know you could be at the beach. I'm going to talk, my goal in this presentation is to contribute to understanding a little bit about the ways that social and ideological factors work in our attempts to implement language revitalization in projects, and so both the way they impact the people we're working with and the way our sort of assumptions and ways of functioning contribute to the outcomes of the projects that we're attempting to implement. And thinking specifically about these issues with respect to urban and diasporic indigenous communities, which have particularly different needs with respect to language revitalization. And then I think there's a call at this point to sort of elaborate the conversation about what language revitalization is to consider those social needs. I'm talking in a fairly broad way here. I think I'm trying a bit to give a big picture perspective on the place where I was working in a way that it's a very complex social and linguistic situation, so I hope I'm able to do it justice by speaking in these kind of broad terms. So where is that? Which was not present from the title, as became clear in our conversation beforehand. I was working in the city of São Gabriel da Cachoeira, Brazil, which is located in the far northwest corner of the Brazilian Amazon. It is the seat of a municipality that has borders with both Colombia and Venezuela. It's geographically quite large, the municipality itself. Most of the territory is, except for the city, is federally designated official indigenous territory. The urban population, the total population of the municipality is about 35 or 40,000. The urban population is about half of that at 20,000. In the municipality as a whole, it's 95% indigenous, and even in the city, it's about 85%, most of whom are very recent migrants, either this generation or a previous generation, maximum two generations removed from living in the rural indigenous territories. It's an extremely interesting place to study language and indigenous cultures for a number of reasons. It's well known, the Northwest Amazon, for high levels of individual and societal multilingualism. There are 19 indigenous languages still spoken in and around São Gabriel. They belong to 5 different language families. As might be presumed from the high proportion of indigenous people, there's also a very well-organized indigenous political movement that plays a prominent role in local politics, led by the FUEN, the Federation of Organizations of Indigenous People of the Rio Negro. And one of their success stories has been the implementation of a system of differentiated indigenous schooling along the schools of the interior. This is a factor both of cultural preservation and of increasing indigenous autonomy. Another aspect of that work in collaborating with linguists and academics, other academics with indigenous people, has been the declaration in 2002 of 3 indigenous languages, Baniwa, Tucano, Nyangatsu, some of the largest of the area, as co-official at the municipal level. This happened in 2002, and this is sort of one of the less successful strategies, and it was particularly targeting the urban area, so some of the questions of why they haven't been able to get it off the ground, despite a lot of interest and a lot of talk about it, are kind of the sort of motivating questions that I went through my research with. An important thing in São Gabriel is that there's not a question of raising awareness about the value of language. People are very aware about the value of continuing their language and the importance and what it means. They've had a lot of contributions from, there's a lot of interest of academics in language and culture in the area. And most of it has been targeted at rural communities. So what's ended up sort of happening is the urban population experiences this loss without really having a sense of what they can do about it. So that's kind of where I'm coming from and looking at why they've been sort of throwing a lot of energy at a problem that they're well aware of without getting anything to really take a lot of traction. So I think language ideologies presents a sort of useful way of looking at some of the non-technical aspects of what they're facing. It's not just a linguistic question, but also an emotional one, and what's not taking hold is relating to that. So highlighting some of the kinds of problems in ways that are maybe obvious and a little less obvious. Obviously, coming to an urban area constitutes a major lifestyle shift away from living in the rural Amazon. They are moving from a subsistence agricultural collective sharing community to a market economy where there's reliable electricity, access to Portuguese language media, and increased contact with non-Indigenous institutions. Indigenous language use in the urban center publicly is still a politicized act, though that has been shifting, especially with things like the co-officialization law. But what I find interesting in this context is that the use of Portuguese has come to be the language even within the home once people move into the city. So I talked to a number of families where people about my age or a little bit younger, sort of 20 to 30, would have been born in the community and come to the city at 5, 6, 7 years old, and within a few years their parents were using Portuguese with them. They may still use their Indigenous language with each other, but with the children, especially as new children were born in the city, they would use Portuguese. So there's I sort of attribute this to some of the ways that the ideology that the language belongs to a specific place is being transported into the city. So the city is Portuguese space, even in the home where the same people were speaking Indigenous languages there speak Portuguese here. That's the one I want. And I associate this as well with a way that being Indigenous is ideologically connected to living in a rural way. When you talk to people about what it means to be Indigenous, a lot of the kinds of things that they highlight involve things that are very difficult to implement in the city. And the ways of making sure that the culture and language can be preserved have revolved primarily around trying to prevent the rural exodus. Implementing the system of schooling has been a part of that, and because education was a major motivating factor, bringing people to the city. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But there's also a way that the Fuiren, the structure of the Indigenous political movement, plays into this as well, because as I said, it's quite powerful in local politics. But the way it's organized is Fuiren's made up of a series of sub-organizations that represent different rural territories. They represent different river systems in the area. There's no representation for the 20,000 urban people. There's no one, if they have a concern as Indigenous people, they don't sort of have a body, a person that they can talk to. Where they would have to go is to the organization that represents the community of their ethnic origin, which maybe they've never been to. And maybe their interests are not really the same as the interests of the people in that community, so there's not really an access to a way to talk about their needs as urban Indigenous people. So it's an erasure of urban environments in discussions of Indigenous people and their language or language use, except insofar as to say, urban is bad for them. Another sort of obvious element with, I think, an additional component to it is that when you move into the urban area, it's a bigger space, your extended families are sort of spread out across the town, and you don't have day-to-day contact with the people who speak the same language as you, your neighbors speak a different language, your grandma's over there, your aunt's over there, you don't have that context. But the other factor involved in that is that this isn't just the breakdown of the speech community is also a major theme in the conversations that I would have with people about why is it hard to be Indigenous in the city, is that this breakup means that people are, that children especially, are not able to, they're losing the respect, the reasons for understanding the way their parents are, and this puts them at risk not just for losing their culture, where they see their parents as backwoods people. They see their parents as belonging to the past. And this puts them at risk not just for losing culture, but also for they become more vulnerable. People say that makes them more vulnerable to the influence of destructive behaviors, the alcohol and the drugs and the violence and the trafficking that is really prominent in the urban center. These are the kinds of social issues that I've sort of grouped together with these kinds of behaviors. I think that you know, one of the sort of motivations drawing me to talk about some of this stuff was, you know, the number of times I would get into conversations in San Gabriel about language and find these people so occupied with these absolutely soul-sucking concerns with their family members falling into drugs and alcohol and victims of violence, and the number, knowing people, young people who committed suicide because of this, and starting to see, you know, so why it sort of makes you go, why are we talking about language in this? But I do think that there's a reason to be talking about language in this. And thinking about what relationships we can build. There's been a very good understanding of how language revitalization in the rural territories and why it's so important to keep people where they are, because language is such a significant part of this holistic understanding of the ways of being. And preventing the exodus is something that I want to emphasize that this is not in any way intending to discourage the kinds of projects that support the rural communities. I think those are extremely important, but I think there are sort of two reasons to add to them and supplement them with looking at the urban context. And the first is that the strategies, for example, of building a school to prevent the student from needing to leave to get education, it only works so far, because once students are completing their education, they're leaving to seek out opportunities to use that education. And the other elements of it is there are factors way beyond the control. Climate change has been a huge, huge role in the region in recent years. In the sort of 4 years I've been following events in San Gabriel, there's been every second year either record level flooding or record level droughts in the rainy season, which droughts prevent boats from getting in and flooding prevents them from being able to grow appropriately. So if they can't feed themselves, they're going to come to the city no matter what. And I would love to stop climate change, but I can't. And the other factor is that there are people who live in the city. They've been born in the city. This is where they're raised. This is where they have their families. There are various reasons they're not going back to those old communities. And they experience this as a very personal loss. We as linguists are walking in and talking about the importance of their language and what we should do about it. And then they see their children unable to speak it, and they feel sort of this hopelessness, and they feel that loss of connection to their children and what their children specifically are losing, but don't know how to do anything about it. And that's where I say, like, sort of the first point I want to say in a model of talking about this is to use terminology and concepts that go beyond the idea of preservation. Making sure the language continues is important. If you have a community where there is no continuity in intergenerational transmission, that's your first step. But in many of the cases for the languages in San Gabriel, they're relatively strong, and they're the languages of daily communication in the rural communities, and it's in the urban area and urbanization that's creating a bigger challenge for them. So taking seriously the experiences of the people in the city who want to learn their language and why they're unable to, and trying to open up a dialogue about what it can mean in their daily lives, in and above just the language is continuing. I'm preaching to the choir in saying that language revitalization needs to be taken out of the schools in this context, but it's worth mentioning because in San Gabriel, language research and activism is almost synonymous with the creation of differentiated schools, with literacy development, and with the educational sector. I went in actually hoping not to talk too much about education when I started my field research, because I think I'm like, education, yeah, I get it, but like, what else can we talk about like in the schools and stuff like this? Because it's very difficult to start a language program in the kinds of schools that exist in San Gabriel, which are very mainstream Brazilian schools. And I was always directed towards educational people until I finally gave up and said, okay, I'll talk about education. And the contributions of linguists have been particularly sort of driven towards the educational sector in terms of the creation of pedagogical materials, the creation of materials that can be used in the differentiated schools, and things like that. And I think that in addition to that, we might want to expand what we do into looking at, say, other sectors. The co-officialization law includes like tons of text about where else the language should be used and should be implemented. And I think that it's worthwhile to start focusing on them. I think particularly the healthcare sector is a particularly beneficial one. because of experiences of extreme discrimination within the healthcare sector and miscommunication that make people who are speakers of other languages really suffer the consequences of this difference. And so that would involve the training and selection of translators, picking out appropriate terms, trying to really push people, and this is something that is happening, the capacitization of Indigenous people to work in these kinds of spaces, but to really imagine ways that we get outside the schools as language activists. And third, to address the discontinuities and disunities of urban space. So I guess what I want to say with that is when we think about how we create products to serve a community, we sort of assume the pre-existence of that community. And in this kind of space, what might be more important is to imagine how we might help to create that community. And I think there are lots of useful models that I've been hearing about over the course of this conference that help us to do that. I think I'm not saying these don't exist in other places. I just think about how to implement them and focus on them. I think the Language Center models, some of the sort of modified master-apprentice kinds of things, group kinds of things that create these connections and reestablish them in new space are something we need to focus on. And finally, I think that we can benefit from research outside of linguistics, as the theme of this conference has demonstrated. I come from Canada, and so when I hear people talking about language revitalization in Canada, there's a lot of reference to understanding what reclaiming language means for recovering from historical trauma and ongoing trauma of colonization. And I think that most of the people who are engaging with that work are either Indigenous people themselves, psychologists, psychiatrists, in consultation with linguists. And there's some productive ideas from this that may translate into the Amazon, where a boarding school environment and dislocation and disruption was a characteristic of the recent past. There's ongoing anthropological work in the area that is engaging with cultural aspects of alcoholism, suicide, and violence among the populations, but there's not much drawing linguists or language into the conversation about what's happening. And I don't have a good sense of exactly what that would mean. I just sort of think that there's an entry point there. Because these are the most significant concerns that people have, I think that we, as people who are concerned with the community, need to investigate what our role in them is. My conclusions are very question marky. the idea of language and cultural health as a holistic entity is definitely present in São Gabriel, but it's often kind of associated with a defeatism when it comes to moving into the urban area. It's because it's holistic, it belongs there, and coming here, you lose parts of it, and that means you lose all of it. And that sort of scares me. And I think that we, as linguists and anthropologists, might need to engage more deeply with the challenges of urbanization and the ways of drawing that in together as a holistic thing in a different space, a new kind of holistic cultural health project. And language documentation efforts say help the language, and that's obviously really important, but they don't necessarily work with all of the people who want the language. And I think expanding our way of talking about that. So that's why I sort of called this presentation revitalizing what? Urbanization exacerbates a number of problems that are related to language revitalization, including a discontinuity of communities and the fracturing of familial relationships. And we're coming in talking about language revitalization as a means of helping to strengthen communities, identities, and contact between generations. But in the city, I think that means diving into tough situations that are often sort of outside of our areas of expertise and our comfort zones. There's a powerful sense of hope in talking about revitalization. And I talked to a lot of people who had been really engaged with this sense of hope, and then for it sort of felt a big drop when realizing that the products that they were working with and that were being produced, they weren't working for them, and not understanding why they aren't able to make that work for them. And that's the where I think is there's a good opportunity to continue deepening our conversation. Thank you.
There's time for questions.
So what you mentioned towards the end, I think really struck a chord with me because working with refugees and the traumatic experience is really, there are a lot of parallels between working with refugees and with indigenous people moving to the urban areas. I'm wondering, I know that working with refugee agencies, we've discovered that a lot of the mental health issues and a lot of the sort of sense of self has really improved within the community when we've worked on language projects. I'm wondering if that's the same there. Or
it's not something that's been really examined there. And that's, so I think that's one of the steps to looking at it, is to start to, I heard Sherry's talk yesterday about looking at that, about not the outcomes in terms of programs or sort of language-related outcomes, but really starting to talk to people about what that means in their mental health. So I think that's the first step, or one of them, personally.
Thank you for a very enlightening presentation. I was wondering, with Sal Gabriel, is there, I don't know if I missed this in the course of the presentation, but is there a group of people that are the traditional custodians of that particular place?
Oh, good question.
And as a kind of connection to that, how are they sort of being involved in the whole sort of language policies of that area?
Right.
Where is there room for hybridity, I guess?
Yeah, good question. Really complicated answer. The Sao Gabriel is at the Rio Negro, very close to the where the Rio Sana and the Rio Valpez comes off, and so it becomes sort of a gathering spot for people from all of those areas. The main population, the main languages of the Rio Negro, that spot specifically, I believe that was Bare. It's kind of unknown. It's not clear exactly who spoke what language in that specific spot. If it was Bare, which it kind of is claimed to be, whether that's accurate or not is a separate question, that language is dead. They have become speakers of an imported Tupi language, Tupi Guarani language, Nyangatu. And so insofar as an indigenous language is seen as belonging to the urban area, it's Nyangatu. But there's a challenge there because Nyangatu is still questioned as an indigenous language. Its status as indigenous, it was brought by Jesuits, who it's spoken in other parts of Brazil, and brought by Jesuits into the region. It's been there for 400 or 500 years, and so they've reconceptualized it as an indigenous language, but other residents of the area, it's, and so the Bare identity and the Nyangatu language are often sort of seen as part of a hybrid, like a not an indigenous enough people. So the dominant sort of cultural model tends to be the Tucanoan model, because in terms of sort of presenting themselves to outsiders as authentic Indians, the Tucano have been able to do that most effectively. So you see a lot of the Bare indigenous leaders making sure they're adopting Tucanoan customs, because that's how you are. So there's lots of examples of this, and it's a really complicated, but the idea that it's anybody's space is contested. And if it's any, it's Nyangatu. Sure.
Question.
If I didn't,
right?
I think
I am also inscribed. In...
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any evidence of kind of creative engagement of this kind of
absolutely
between different language speakers?
Yes, and I can talk to you more about that after, because and it's a long answer.
Awesome. I'm also inscribed and would like to ask a question or make a comment or suggestion.
Sure,
also.
Please.
You mentioned as one possible reason why people give up so easily, even inside their households, the use of their traditional languages, is that the traditional language is so much connected to the picture of the holistic village rural life, so if you lose one part, then you should also give up the language because you're not indigenous anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't know, and that is not an indigenous place, so you're not supposed to speak an indigenous language. I'm not so sure.
Okay.
I'm really, I like you're going into the direction saying, okay, we have to recognize this is urban life, this is not tribal life, so different conditions. So I think in language, try to think what role can language have there?
Hmm.
This is important.
Mm-hmm.
So couldn't the communities there or the language workers there start to develop an urban style of speaking? I think that is what is needed, right?
Yeah.
They have to go to Facebook, they have to use Twitter, they have to use their own Wikipedia, they have to be proud to use their language in other contexts. And often what is missing is the vocabulary, is the way to express to speak about other things.
Yeah.
And that would be language development, which for once doesn't mean Bible translation, but really do something so that people can use their language in a different new context.
Right.
Right.
That exactly. Yeah. I really should have highlighted that actually. I was hearing over and over, sort of one of the ways I started thinking about this was I was hearing over and over that youth in the city just aren't interested. Youth in the city just aren't interested. So I got myself invested with, I happened to be already friends with the person who was the president of the Municipal Youth Council and worked for the youth department. And so I was like, hey, can you connect me with some youth? Because I'm not very young anymore. So I got to talk, and she introduced me to a hip hop dance group, the capoeira group, the theater group, a group of radio people. And I started talking to them about how to do this. None of them are speakers. So I started talking to them, and they were really excited about it, right? So yeah, I think that's exactly one of the areas. And I think that there's been a challenge because there's sort of some pushback from the indigenous movement, right? They're like, no, we need to focus the linguists on working there.
Mm.
And we need to document our traditional knowledge. We don't need new ways. This is changing things too much. And there's a resistance, especially to people who are born in the city.
Well, this is exactly giving up use of indigenous languages in the city.
Yeah. So I'm being controversial in the city as I sort of say that and say, let's go talk to these youth who are non-speakers. People were very confused by me. They were like, what do you mean you want to talk to somebody who doesn't speak the language? Like, that's why I want to talk to them, right? So thank you. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Still have,
Do those people who live in urban area, do they keep any contact or connection to the
most of the time, yes.
Okay, so this is, culturally, geographically very remote, but you might find a lot of similar examples in Polynesia. Because Polynesian people, for example, Maori, people have pointed out that urbanization, breakup of the community, led to the language loss. And we have a lot of migration into islands, and then you have a lot of diaspora Polynesian communities in New Zealand, and there is some movement. And there's very interesting study about Pokelauan in Oahu, here on this island.
Yeah.
How they study it, really the community building that you were talking about, and how they studied it as language revitalization, but ended up doing cultural revitalization, but they found that what youth kids are interested in is the cultural dance song. They get very, motivated.
Right.
So,
can you give me that reference afterwards?
Sure.
Thank you. We have time for another question?
One, yes.
Okay. No.
Because I think that's probably one of the key problems,
in
Australia. Bottom line is our languages are, I hate to say it, but they're relevant to us, but they're not relevant to the broader world.
Yeah.
So in order to operate outside of the community, you've got to be able to speak English. That's the bottom line. It's the only one of the dominant language.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like what you've got is the same situation.
It's quite similar.
Right.
Yeah.
The colonies that created
at the federal level, at the federal level in Brazil, it's one of the reasons that the schools have become such an important feature, really, is the recent constitution in Brazil, where it leaves room for indigenous languages is in schools. And so that's where they have somewhere to work with, and the differentiated schooling has been so important because they have some government support for it. And the idea of the co-officialization law at the municipal level was to try to work beyond that. One of my broader tasks is to look at, okay, well, if that's the case, then why hasn't it actually been implemented? And part of that is corruption in the local municipal government. There's additional factors. Trying to move outside schools is a big challenge, and part of it's the policy structure. Thank you.
Thank you again.